And welcome in to the rare Saturday afternoon edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. I'm your host and all-around Nets expert, Gavin Shaw. I covered the Phoenix Suns for 3 years, but moved back to my native New York to give you everything you need on the Brooklyn Nets beat. And I'm joined, as always, by the lifelong fan, Josh Bass. Josh, you've been a Nets fan for more or less 16 years, I want to say. But after the Knicks have beaten them in back-to-back games by a combined score of 21 points, would you say it's time to disband the Brooklyn Nets?
Oh, never, Gavin. I've been a Nets fan. I had my Nets fan bar mitzvah 3 years ago. Now I'm having my Nets fan Sweet 16.
Your quinceañera.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? I'm going to grow old as a Nets fan.
Okay. All right. But I don't know. I think it might be time to take the team.
It's a terrible matchup for the Nets. Even without Porzingis, they have all these offensive rebounders. Courtney Lee, Nets for when he would trade to us and had a miserable season. But he decides to go off. And listen, it was just not a good matchup for us. I don't think there's a huge disparity between these two teams, but last year the Knicks were a lot better than the Nets in relative terms. The Nets would just beat them, I think, 3 out of 4 times. So these things change every season, just different mix of players and energy on the floor.
All right, I appreciate your positive spin on it. There, to your point, though, there is nothing scarier than a Courtney Lee scorned. All right, before we get into that recap and the Raptors recap, I wanted to give you guys a heads up. We are going to be doing a two-part podcast today. So two podcasts for the price of one, Knicks Raptors breakdown, and then as promised, our trimester of our Nets podcast baby award show. So we are really excited about that. All right, Josh, let's get right into it. 2 nights ago, it was a Thursday night game, the Knicks knocking off the Brooklyn Nets in Brooklyn 111-104, and this was kind of a surprising result considering Kristaps Porzingis only playing 18 minutes, scoring 13 points, 4 assists, and leaving with a left knee soreness. But as you prefaced earlier, Courtney Lee having the game of his life, 27 points, 4 rebounds, 3 assists. And then the Knicks bench playing exceptionally well, led by Michael Beasley's 15-4 in 20 minutes.
Yeah, Beasley... Well, he can be a useful player because he does take a lot of shots and he can get a shot off with average efficiency at least. So especially when Porzingis is out, that could be tough to stop. You know, the Nets had a great comeback in the third quarter. They took a 3-point lead, but then they kind of got out of control. Kyle Quinn was getting one or two offensive rebounds on every possession. And when you're defending 2 or 3 times in a row, and then you're immediately sprinting back for a fast break, you're just going to get tired. And the key, in my opinion, was when Caris LeVert and Joe Harris were kind of out of control the last 2 or 3 minutes of the third quarter. The Knicks go on an 8-0 run to take a 5-point lead into the fourth, and then the Nets couldn't get over that hump in the entire fourth quarter. And this is a game they have to win. Allen Crabbe was horrible, and I'm sure we'll talk a lot more about him.
Yeah. No, this was the second game in a row he could not hit a shot. One night after going 1-for-14, from 3-point range, 1-for-7 this time around. So the 2-for-21 for a guy who fancies himself, and I think we fancy generally, as an elite 3-point shooter. I think he was due for a bit of a downturn, and I think that was kind of reflected. And I know he had like a minor injury, but in Kenny Atkinson sitting him against the Raptors, he was shooting so well. He was going to have an off game, but it got really ugly really fast for him. That certainly didn't help things. And then, yeah, outside of Spencer Dinwiddie, Rondé Hollis-Jefferson, the starters as a whole played pretty well now that I'm looking at it. Allen Crabbe had an off-shooting night. Every other guy shooting at least 50% from the field. Dinwiddie, 26-7. Hollis-Jefferson, a career-high 25 points, 7 rebounds, 3 assists, 4 steals. That's a career-high for Dinwiddie too, right, Josh? 26?
Yeah, career-high for Dinwiddie as well.
Yeah, and then no one on the bench with Jahlil Okafor, Nick Stauskas not playing and making their Nets debuts. The next game, no one else on the bench shooting over 50%, and the bench, this is going to be some quick math on my part, but they went a combined 8-for-27 from the field. That's not great.
Yeah, it's pretty terrible. Joe Harris has also slowed down with his 3-point shooting, going 1-of-7. And listen, going back to Crabbe for a second, my problem with him, like, he's going to have off nights, especially when you're a three-point shooter, you're not going to shoot 40% every game. There's going to be some variance there. But he just doesn't contribute at all when he's not hitting threes. And he's scored less than 6 points in 25% of his games this season, Gavin. So he is very susceptible to having terrible nights where he can't do anything and seems like he's in his own head. When he's not hitting threes, the rest of his game suffers. It's been a huge disappointment. And for making $18 million a year, I hope that Sean Marks knew what he was doing and saying that Kenny Atkinson will be able to unlock his game. But now it really looks like a dark mark on the Marks era that he hasn't been able to A, improve, or B, that Marks didn't get an asset in that trade with Portland.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's kind of interesting because you see the guys who are kind of elite three-point shooters in the NBA, like J.J. Redick, Kyle Korver. It's like it's even with them, and they're like kind of like the best possible versions of Crabbe. You see a little bit of the same thing where they, or if they're not hitting shots, they're not really great players. But I know J.J. in particular finds a way to start hitting long twos and getting to the basket and drawing a couple fouls. And then both those guys are just solid enough defensively and such great shooters that their gravity still has a really big impact night in and night out. And I don't know, I think Crabbe is getting to that point where he just has that respect as a shooter that he's going to pull guys out no matter what, but he's not quite there. And the thing that frustrates me with Crabbe is that he does have other aspects of his game, even though they're not fully developed. We've seen him game in and game out, make a couple nice deflections on defense every single night. And more than that, he started figuring out how to attack the basket, and more so than he was doing early in the season, changing pace and finding ways to get to the rim with like little hesitations and then using his length to be effective there. But it seems like that's a tool he only pulls out when he's shooting well. And to some degree, that is just kind of natural because obviously you can leverage your shot better into creating room for drives when it's going in. But he just doesn't even try. And so to me, it's more of a mentality thing, and that's something Kenny Atkinson has to drive into his head. And if he doesn't, you're absolutely right. That's not going to be a good investment because you don't want to pay $70 million for a guy who's hit or miss.
My difference between Crabbe and some of the other premier shooters is that last year Crabbe had incredible percentage. I think he shot 44% from three, but he took under four attempts a game, and that's not a lot of volume for someone that's considered a three-point specialist, especially with the amount of minutes he played. And now that he's taking a lot more threes, up to seven a game, and he's taking more difficult looks, his percentage has plummeted. So I can't compare him to guys like Korver and J.J. Redick, who maintain the volume of that many threes taken per 36 minutes, but also maintain a percentage well into the 40s.
Yeah, that's fair. He is at 37% on the season. That was closer to 38 or 39 before the last two games. So hopefully he can get that back. Let's talk about some good stuff now. Yeah. What did you? I mean, obviously Dinwiddie and Hollis Jefferson were both great. Like the Knicks, I thought it was pretty interesting. I can't remember if it was Ian Eagle or Jim. I think it might have been Jim Smarkle who, or it could have even been. No, it was Kenny Atkinson actually who made the comparison. He compared Rondé's game to like a knuckleballer and just like his like pace and like the weird like arm angles he throws shots, particularly layups, up at. Like kind of throw guys off, and he like he's kind of I don't know like what the best word to describe it is, but he's almost a unique player in that sense that like he really does throw off defenders' timing, and I think we really saw it against the Knicks. They just didn't really know what to make of him, and he kind of feasted because of it.
Yeah, you know, he's kind of going at his own pace. Like to use a football analogy, he's like an Anquan Boldin type where he's going so slowly, but he knows how to use his body and contort just to make a catch. I never feel comfortable when Rondé has the ball in his hands, but credit to him because his shot making has become so much better. And to think that he has become a pretty solid offensive contributor and to look how far he's come since his first year in the league and even first 2 years in the league, it's pretty remarkable. Also, shout out to Tyler Zeller because he was pretty good in the Knicks game, and the Nets completely fell apart when he was not playing the five.
Yeah, and this has kind of been a pattern. I've written it down, like, we haven't talked about it that much on the podcast, but I've written it down, like, four or five games in a row. I don't really understand why Mozgov's a part of the rotation, and not to dip too far into the Raptors game, but I don't mind if we go back and forth a little bit. Was Jared Allen hurt against Toronto? Because I was confused why he didn't play. I'm assuming he was injured.
I don't think he was. I think they might have been resting him on the back-to-back. Kenny Atkinson did say in the post-game presser that he thought Mozgov was a better matchup, but that might just be covering up for Allen resting and saying that, just to hype Mozgov up a little bit and give him some confidence, because God knows he needs it. He just lost three straight passes at one point. He has no hands, can't finish. I could go on a long laundry list of things, but it's not his fault that the Lakers gave him that huge contract and that Kenny Atkinson plays him. But listen, if the game against Indiana tomorrow, if Mozgov's playing and Allen or Okafor's not, then I will be very concerned, because at this point, it should be a three-man center rotation of Zeller, Allen, and Okafor, and that seems pretty clear to both of us and also every Nets fan on the planet.
Yeah. Unless you had any final thoughts on that Knicks game again, I don't think anything that special happened. And I think I kind of had the same take in both the Knicks game and the Raptors game, where they got down early, big deficits in the first quarter, second quarter, and then they had the big comeback. Like in the Raptors game, it was all about Nick Stauskas coming in, scoring 15 points in the first 6 minutes of his Nets career, which was absolutely astounding to watch. And then you saw the Nets run out of steam. I think both of these games, they probably weren't going to beat the Raptors in Toronto without Damari Carroll either way. But I thought both of these games were representative of that Mexico City trip starting to take a toll on this Nets team a couple days later. And then the back-to-back going to a third country probably really overextended that. But they just looked exhausted to me. There were those two stretches where they played with a lot of verve and really moved the ball around. And other than that, they just looked wiped out, to me at least.
Yeah, I mean, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson played 37 minutes. The next game, Dinwiddie and Crabbins played 35. I'm not really sure why Crab played 35 when he was so poor. But I think, the depth is kind of taking a little bit of a hit, especially without Booker and getting Okafor and Stauskas up to speed. There is kind of that lull where some guys are forced to play more minutes with the second unit. But I thought LeVert played really well in the first half, hitting threes. I think that second half, he kind of showed that he is a very young player still and is still learning, because he had a lot of silly turnovers like he always does. I thought that he really kind of didn't do a good job controlling the pace, especially in that third quarter. Jared Allen had a run of fantastic games up to this point, but he got beasted on the boards by Kyle Quinn and really needs to get stronger, because he is not a good defensive rebounder at this point. And when you play him alongside a guy like Quincy Acey, who's undersized, it's gonna be tough for the Nets to compete when you're playing against a certain type of team. Can we just talk about Courtney Lee for a quick second?
Yeah, go ahead.
I feel like he's had a really odd career. I was just looking at his basketball reference page before, and what team do you identify him with?
Kind of the Magic, honestly, in my mind, just because he only had the finals with them. Yeah.
Yeah, so I agree with that, and it's insane to me, because I feel like everyone would think he's a Magic player, or at least a plurality of people, but he was only on their team for one season before they traded him, and he bounced around so much. I don't even remember him playing on Houston for two seasons, Boston, that sounds vaguely familiar, but he's bounced around, been on six different teams, and it's so weird that the one team he's remembered for is he's only on them for 1 year out of his 10-year career.
Was the Magic his rookie year, or was that
his rookie year, and then they traded him to the Nets that following season, offseason. Yeah. For Vince Carter and Ryan Anderson.
I forgot, was he the one who missed the layup that would have won the finals game? Or was that someone else?
It was
game two, and it could have been him. It might have been Jameer Nelson. I don't.
Ray for Alston or Jameer Nelson.
Yeah, that Magic. I still can't believe that Magic team. That's a testament to how good Dwight Howard was, and rookie Courtney Lee was playing for that. Even though he was sneaky competent as
and
a rookie.
Ito and Rashard Lewis. That was a nice team.
Yeah. No. They were good, and Jameer Nelson was a borderline All Star that year. But yeah, still, that's kind of crazy. All right, anyways, just a couple of miscellaneous thoughts on Knicks Nets, and then we can get in. I thought it was really funny earlier in the game. There was a really bad foul call on Dinwiddie, and he looked at the ref and screamed, "No! How?" And I just thought that was a little...
Dinwiddie complains a lot.
Yeah, you know, he does. He's perpetually angry, I feel like. And and a lot of time, I feel like there are maybe because I focus in on him since he's always reacting. I do feel like he gets a lot of bad calls, and maybe that's just because he's long arms and is also a better player than his reputation suggests he is. So he doesn't necessarily get the quote unquote superstar calls, which maybe he doesn't warrant yet, but he gets the same amount of respect from the refs as any rookie does, and he maybe deserves a little bit more. But I feel like it probably doesn't help that, like, he gives, like, the wide-eyed, like, look at the refs, like, you're insane every time they call something against him.
Yeah, I get really worried because, obviously, he's our best and most important player at this point, so I'm always worried that he's going to get a tech. But I think the problem with him that he feels is that he doesn't get the same calls on offense, because I know that he tries to do the, like, the BS three-point, like, lean in and get a foul called, which the refs have kind of de-emphasized this year, giving that call.
Yeah.
And that was his bread and butter last season. So he gets mad when he doesn't get it. And then when there's, like, a touchdown on the other end, he'll with that and just walk away in the other direction.
Yeah. All right. Two other final quick notes. I say this a lot on the podcast, but it bothers me every time. I think the Nets, like, pretty consistently, like, miss Jared Allen on the roll. Like, I think Kenny Atkinson has some really good sets involving Allen where he'll take a pick, and then the ball handler, usually like Caris LeVert or Dinwiddie, will pass it on to someone else, and then like the defense will be distracted just because there's so much shooting around the floor, and Allen will have space. And if you threw like a good pass in that area, you'd get easy dunk after easy dunk. And I think we see that when Caris LeVert's in the game, because he's the one guy who's really, really good about this, and he's always looking for Allen on that role. And it just seems like everyone else on the Nets, with the exception of probably Spencer Dinwiddie, just because he's such a good passer, they have their head down so often that like they never see these guys cutting to the basket, and like occasionally they'll throw a good pass, but it's only like when the roller is coincidentally in their line of vision. And like I'm using Allen as the big picture example of that, because I notice it with him most often just because he's like the best lob target on the team. But I see that happen with like a lot of different guys cutting for the Nets, and like it's like Atkinson draws these good sets, but then they just don't quite execute on it in game.
Well, it doesn't seem natural. I feel like LeVert especially, like, he either is looking for the roll to Allen and or the lob to Allen, and then in that case, he'll just force feed it to him whether he's open or not, or he'll just take it to the basket and not look. Like, it seems predetermined whether he's going to hit the roll man or not.
Yeah, and I guess that, but to be fair for, like, younger guys, and I guess, like, the other guys on this team aren't really natural passers, that's kind of how most people read the game. I thought it was pretty, not to get too sidetracked, but I thought it was pretty interesting. I was reading, like, an interview with Kevin Durant this year, and he was talking about, like, it took for him till, like, he was on the Warriors, which is already, like, the 10th season of his career, I think, to, like, stop, like, predetermining reads. But that was something, like, it wasn't just, like, something he, like, realized he had to work on. Like, it took him years and years and years at the NBA level to figure that out. And I think for guys who, like, aren't Spencer Dinwiddie, who's just a really natural passer and floor general and has really good eyes, it does take a long time to do that, because these guys grow up and, like, they spend their whole careers, like, never looking to pass, and like that just doesn't really have to be part of their game. Or on the other hand, they were so talented relative to their competition that they'd create so much space that reads would be relatively easy. And I think with Caris LeVert, that's almost even an issue for him on the NBA level, because you see so many times when he's getting assists, it's just because he's like breaking down the entire defense, and he doesn't really have to make complex reads just because he can get to the basket so easily. So that is a skill that takes a while to develop. All that being said, I kind of, even though I know you took a little bit of an issue with it, I'd prefer if LeVert, like, kind of go, if he is going to predetermine reads, and that's, like, all he's capable of at this point in his career, I'd prefer if he went in the direction of being really aggressive in passing the ball to Allen, because I made the reference on another podcast, but I really think that's, like, such a big part about what makes the James Harden Clint Capella duo so deadly. It's that Harden always wants to make that pass, and even if he has to make it on tight margins, he's going to force it in there, and it's really, really efficient. So I'd like to see more teammates kind of play like that with Jared Allen.
Yeah, you know, it's tough because there's a mix. When you have Jared Allen on the floor, I think he's using the role man a lot more. But also, at the same point yesterday, Mozgov was playing, and you could see the frustration from Nets point guards who would constantly put him in good positions to score, and he would just fumble the pass. And that makes the guards less likely to hit the role man and just try to do it themselves. So there needs to be a balance, and that's why I think Mozgov shouldn't be playing, because he kind of ruins the confidence of other guys on the team.
Yeah, and Okafor was having a lot of the same issues, though. I'd put that more on Rust.
He wasn't rolling at all. He was just standing at the 3-point.
Well, yeah, but there was one or two plays where like they threw it to him inside and he kind of fumbled it. But yeah, I put that down more as Rust, because he normally has great hands. So I think he's someone who's actually, and I think that's what's been so great about Zeller, and you could tell, because Dinwiddie doesn't even have to like think about it, like when he's passing the ball, like with Mozgov, you could tell he started taking a little bit off it, and Mozgov is still losing it. But Zeller, it's funny, because like Spinarkle was like kind of going into it, and we were like, I've been thinking this whole year, and like, I figure you've had some of the same thoughts since you kind of doubted Tyler Zeller, and rightfully, based on how good he's been in this NBA, in his NBA career. But it's really interesting because he's really not doing anything complicated. He's just rolling hard, rolling at the right time, and catching and finishing well. It's like these like basic fundamental pick and roll things, and we talked about how like through like the late, or I guess like early 2010s, like the NBA was a pick and roll league, and now it's getting even more complicated than that. And it's all about 3-point shooting off pick and rolls, and it's about dribble handoffs, and it's kind of evolved past that. Even but like just the basic pick and roll is working really, really well with Tyler Zeller, just because he's mastered those skills. And it's going to be interesting to see if with Okafor in there instead of Mozgov, if, as you said, like Nets guards can kind of be confident across the board in their bigs to make plays if they pass them the ball in those situations. Oh, well, so that was supposed to be a small conversation, but it ended up turning into a whole segment. All right, final thing is I loved Joe Harris and Doug McDermott just automatically guarding each other whenever the duo were in the game. And it was the same thing when, like, the Nets play the Cavs and, like, Kyle Korver's in there. And I suspect when they play the Sixers, Harris has got to guard Redick. It's like the white shooters just, like, gravitate towards each other. And I don't know if that's, like, the coaches, like, I wonder if that's a thing in the NBA. Do coaches, like, I'm sure with the best player, they say you guard him. But, like, is there freedom amongst the other guys, like as guys sub in and out to like pick and choose who they guard? It just seems like the white shooters like always gravitate towards each other, and then like they inevitably just cancel each other out because they're so good at running around screens on offense and defense.
You know, I didn't notice this because I don't see race.
So. Yeah, I forgot about that. Sorry.
Yeah, you know,
I forgot you were colorblind. Yeah. My fault. All right. Okay.
Joe Harris is also guarding DeRozan, the primary national last
name. I know that's a different game. Do the Raptors have the Raptors don't have like a white shooter that's like the same size as them?
Do they have?
No, they don't. They don't. There's no Ron Bakur. There's no Doug McDermott. Yeah, we would have really known this was an issue if Joe Harris had gone up to like Valanciunas and said, "Yeah, I got him." Yeah. All right. Well. Okay. We've gone in and out. We've talked about the Raptors game a little bit. Haven't totally gone down that rabbit hole yet. But let's get into it. We already hinted at it. But Josh, I want the full reaction from you because you sent me like an all caps text while it was happening. Like how amazing was the start of Nick Stauskas's career?
That was incredible. I really want him to just retire today. I feel like that would cement his legacy. But, you know, he was kind of timid out there at first. Didn't really want to look for a shot, kind of playing in the system of the offense. But once Quincy Acey just threw him the ball with, like, a second left and he had to chuck him a three, which he made, I think from there he was just like, okay, you know what, I'm just going to shoot when I have it. I've been in Kenny Atkinson's system. He's empowering me to play my game. And he was just draining threes. He had one great take to the basket on an and-one. He was stellar. I really was impressed by him. I don't think he's going to keep that up, obviously, but it's nice to see that he has the potential to deliver a stellar game like that.
Yeah. Can I throw this out there? Like, I've been not to pile on with Alan Crabb because we've been doing it all podcast, but I just want to get in one more thing. I've said it with Joe Harris this year. I don't think Nick Stauskas is quite as good of a player as Crabb. If not, I think he would have been a rotation player in Philly for sure. But, like, I think he showed tonight that, like, at his best, he does pretty much exactly what Crabb does at his best. And, like, Stauskas, you're paying him, like, $5 million to do it instead of, like, $16 or $17 million. That's all. I'll just throw
also,
that out there.
Stauskas, 7 rebounds, low key.
Yeah, he's, like, he's always been, like, a pretty good athlete. My big issue with him, and, like, this was, like, emphasized last night, and I think I've thought about this for years because so many times you see guys like kind of like Stauskas who like don't really play for some teams and then go on a worse team and they like suddenly like start really producing and you're like, why can't he play those minutes on a good team and do that? And what I've kind of boiled it down to, and this is true for both Stauskas and Julius Okafor from what I observed last night, again, really small sample size, but just kind of the feeling I got. Both those guys, when they're on the court, they just kind of stop the ball a little bit. Like, I think both of them are actually really good offensive players, at least really good scorers. Like, Okafor, like, we already knew, like, he has the face-up game, great touch around the basket, even though he didn't show it last night, has really good hands. Stauskas, like, people think about him as just a shooter, but he's a good athlete. Like he showed it. Like I think it ended up getting called back as an offensive foul, but he had one play where like he exploded into the lane and he dunked it. He had another play like a few years ago. I forgot who it was against, but he like dropped a guy and then had a wraparound assist to, it might've been Nerlens Noel for a dunk. Like he's like a really good athlete. He can get to the rim. He can shoot. But those guys, like you just don't see them touch the ball and then make that like quick extra pass to a guy in the corner. Maybe if you play both of them more, like with the guys on this Nets team, like everyone always says, passing is contagious. We'll start to see more of that, and maybe they'll develop that aspect of their game. But to me, that's kind of the big issue with both of them, is I think in a vacuum, they're both really good offensive players. But to fit in well, particularly in a system like the Nets, you have to be able to like make that extra pass and just make quick, smart, rapid basketball decisions instead of holding the ball, taking two dribbles, and then deciding to launch a three. That was kind of my quick takeaway on it.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And also, what do Stauskas and Okafor have in common? They were both the best player on their college teams, All-Americans, guys that everyone would defer to them. I mean, Stauskas, when he was in college, he would just have the ball at the top of the key. And if he had a switch, he would just try to ISO and get by the guy. And when it comes down to it, in the pros, his handle isn't good enough to kind of beat guys off the dribble. So he needs to adjust and be like, okay, like, listen, I'm going to be like a Joe Harris type where if I have the ball and I don't have anything, I don't have a complete mismatch, just give it up, cut, and get and try to help the offense progress to the next better read, you know, instead of just kind of – there were a couple times last night where he had – it was either Pirtle or Siakam on him where he would try to get by them, and he just couldn't do it. So he has to understand that he needs to move on and make a better read there.
Yeah, I should mention, because we've only talked about Stauskas, the Nets lost 120 – to 87, 33-point defeat. I'm pretty sure that was – I didn't look, but I think that's their worst loss this season. I know the one to the Rockets was pretty bad as well. The Nets had – like, and they kept showing this graphic during the game, and I thought it was pretty telling like to how the Nets have played all year. They've been involved at least going into last night. Now they're tied for the least amount of games decided by 15 or more points all season. And it was like they're not talented enough to blow teams out. They've only done it twice all year, but they've stayed in – game after game after game. And I think this is just the culmination of playing a really good team on a back-to-back. Again, we mentioned the Mexico City factor. No one had any energy, and it just seemed like the Raptors came out like really, really hot, like particularly DeMar DeRozan, who finished – he only shot 4 free throws and still got 31 points because he was 14 of 19 from the floor, which is just ridiculous. Like they were just cooking the whole game. They finished as a team shooting 56% from the field. And the Nets were just the complete opposite. Like, no one outside of Stauskas could hit a shot. They were down by 10 early, went up by like 3 or 4 after Stauskas' run, and then just got blown out at the start of the third quarter. And it was partially energy, partially shooting, but it just seemed like kind of like the perfect storm for Toronto. And it felt like the game was over by like 5 minutes into the third.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough with DeRozan. You need to match up with him with a big wing with size, because he's not going to blow by you. He just wants to get to his spot and then shoot over you. But without Damari Carroll playing, which I think he should have played, honestly, and then you could have sat him out Sunday, but especially against his former team, I would have liked to see him play. But I think he would have been a better matchup. But obviously without him, the only player that can fill that void is Rondae Hollis-Jefferson. But of course, he's stuck guarding Ibaka because they need him to play the four. So DeRozan was able to cook the shooting over guys like Harris, LeVert, Dinwiddie. Like, they didn't really have a chance at stopping him.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I thought, I mean, the other thing that made it awkward, and maybe, I mean, I think, like, you know how, like, I think it was Tom Haberstroh wrote that article on ESPN a couple years back about schedule losses, and it's, like, kind of a phenomena that, like, obviously, like, a coach will never acknowledge publicly, and he probably never even acknowledges it to his players, because you never want a team going in with the mentality, like, we're going to lose this game. I think Carroll sitting, and I think him, like, kind of experimenting with Okafor and Stauskas in this game, and in even putting in Okafor and Mozgov together at the same time, which was really, really weird, because I don't know why they'd ever play that lineup, frankly. I think this was like kind of Atkinson acknowledging that this was going to inevitably be a schedule loss. So he just kind of wanted to see what he had in those two guys. And it was pretty interesting. We did the full breakdown on Stauskas, but like initial thoughts on Okafor, at least for me, were like, I thought he was like, I was kind of stunned by how skinny he was. I mean, we know like he went vegan over the offseason, but what was a little frustrating to me, and it was part of it was probably just like the spacing on the floor and him not totally knowing what to do yet, but he didn't really strike me as like particularly faster than he's been in past seasons, and he didn't really seem better defensively than he's been in past seasons. Like Jim Spanarkel made like a really good note on it. Like every time he was coming out on guys, he was leaning forward, or he was either giving a blow-bys, or he was, like, just letting Big shoot wide-open jumpers on him, which isn't always the worst move, but, like, they were making them tonight. I was hoping that if he had lost weight, it would be, like, compensated for in him being quicker, and that didn't really seem to be the case. Like, he was getting bullied, and guys were still faster than him, which was a little frustrating for me.
Yeah, I mean, he just seems, as you mentioned, he was kind of unsure of himself out there. Steph slow to react, and then he was trying to post up Valanciunas, who is a pretty strong guy and a huge dude, and he's had no traction on him and had to resort to fadeaways. So you have to hope that when he does go up against guys who are maybe more of like a pick and roll type center, like a Capella that you mentioned before, then he can kind of bully them in the post. But he does look really skinny, so he might not have that strength there. And if he doesn't have that strength to back down guys in the post, then he doesn't really have a fit on offense because he's not going to be able to stretch guys out. When he was doing pick and rolls, he was kind of hanging out at the three-point line, which didn't feel right to me because he's not a three-point shooter. So I don't know. Maybe he just didn't want to get in the guy's way, the guard's way, as I mentioned on Twitter. Shout out at Locked On Nets. But you have to be able to time your rolls well to get at least the ball in an area where you can score, because if not, he's not going to have a place on this team.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to mention again, this is a two-parter podcast. So we're talking Knicks Raptors, and then we are putting out another one today, breaking down the Nets' first trimester awards, the best of. We are doing awards such as the best Russian on the team, the most improved player, the MVP, the best game, the best individual performance, and then that's all culminating in our favorite play of the year. So really excited to do that one. We're going to knock it out right after this one, release it later today, Saturday, December 16th. And yeah, really excited for everyone to enjoy that. All right, final thoughts on this Raptors game. We said it, a schedule loss. Yeah, Jahlil Okafor, he did, to your point before on him bullying skinnier guys, like he had like a play like when everyone had probably turned off their TV in like the last 10 minutes where he like had it on the elbow against Jakob Poeltl and just like kind of spun into the lane, backed him down, turned for like a little layup. And that's more of what I think of from Okafor, but I'm just really fascinated like to like where he gets his offense on this team and how like he can fit in where he's not totally like kind of hijacking what the Nets want to do normally. Like it seemed like when he was on the floor, like the Nets were like running like one offense with the four other guys on the floor, and then every once in a while Dinwiddie would throw him the ball, everything would stop, and everyone around the court would watch Okafor try and go one-on-one with his guy. And I'm kind of interested to hear your take on that, Josh, and like how he can kind of fit in within the flow of the offense. Is it just ultimately kind of playing the Tyler Zeller role and maybe being a little bit of a better version of that pick and roll big just because he is bigger and a better finisher than Zeller?
Yeah, I mean, he needs to find where he's comfortable. If he can catch the ball in that 8 to 10 foot range on the move, his hands are good, his touch is good enough to be a force there. But if he's just getting the ball in the post, I mean, he is good at that relative to other players in this league. But at the same time, there is a reason that the league has moved away from post-up players, because it's not as efficient as just running a motion offense or a pick-and-roll offense. So he might be good at it, but that doesn't mean that he should be getting the ball in those situations. So it's going to be up to him to kind of change his game, and also for Kenny Atkinson to find spots where he's comfortable. I mean, if they're on a switch and he's getting guarded by some 6'5 shooting guard, then yeah, throw the ball to him and he can go to work. But he can't expect him to get the ball in every half court set when he's going up against a guy that's the same size as him.
Yeah, no, it's going to be really fascinating to how they find that balance, because I mentioned there are plays where he just flat out ISO'd, but then there are also plays where he was kind of doing everything he could to fit in, and that meant hanging out on the perimeter, and then because he was there, his guy could, and he's made like one three-pointer in his entire career, his man could just double off him. And there's a play where Dinwiddie had a step on, I think it was Kyle Lowry, it was whichever point guard was guarding him, got into the lane, and then Okafor's big slid over, like 4 seconds left on the shot clock. Dinwiddie kicked it out to him in the right corner, and then Okafor just wanted no part of shooting the three, and he took a dribble and just committed the shot clock violation. So that's a tough ask, and like I don't know if that's where Kenny Atkinson wants him, or if that's just where Okafor felt like in the moment he was helping the team the most. But that's why it's like it's such an awkward fit on the surface. And we mentioned that when we like first broke down the trade. Like it is a talent play, but you got to make it work. And it's going to kind of require sacrifices on both sides. The Nets are going to have to like tilt the game plan a little bit in his favor when he's in the game. But at the same time, as you so acutely pointed out, Josh, he's going to have to change up how he plays. All right. Anyways, that'll finish this edition of the Locked.
Can I mention one thing quickly?
Yeah, no problem. Sorry.
Okafor's 3-point shot is really weird. Like, I did not expect that. He has like a behind his head shot like Kevin Garnett, but with the slowest release I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, it's pretty ugly. I'm trying to find it's kind of similar to Mozgov's, but Mozgov's maybe even looks a little bit smoother. And like I don't know, like I'm like a big proponent of like bigs who kind of have like who are really coordinated and have really good touch around the basket, like Okafor. Like I think those guys should like in most cases be able to learn how to shoot 3-pointers. But the issue with Okafor is like, and like maybe this is why like Brook Lopez was like a little bit more successful, or maybe Josh, you could tell me if I'm speaking out of turn on this. But I just think Okafor's hands are so big, and like, and I know it was like a big thing when he was college is that he was almost like had Wilt Chamberlain type hands, and like he would like hold a basketball the same way you or I would hold a grapefruit. Is the constant reference you hear in regards to him. That makes it really, really difficult to shoot, and that's kind of the big theme historically with bigs who can't make free throws and can't hit shots from more than 5 feet away. So I'm interested to see if he can maybe get around that, but I'd be kind of surprised, honestly, if the 3-pointer ever becomes like a big part of his game.
Yeah, I mean, we can hope. You know, who thought that Jared Allen would be hitting a 3 on occasion this year? Even guys like Brook Lopez, who were terrific mid-range shooters that became 3-point weapons. I'm not going to say never, but he has a lot of work to do.
All right. Okay, so we went above and beyond on this podcast, approaching, if not hitting, the 40-minute mark. And we're going to do another one in just a couple of minutes. We're going to knock out that awards show for you. For now, I'm Gavin. Thanks to Josh. If you haven't already, subscribe to the Locked On Nets podcast on iTunes. Leave us a rating or a review. And we are going to have some more interactive stuff in the coming days. We're going to let you guys vote on some of the awards we voted on Twitter. So be on the lookout for that. And keep with the Locked On Podcast Network. Peace out for now.